fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 13 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 13. The Necktie Party. When Diana Henders left the dining room after hearing Corson's explanation of her status as an heir to the estate of her father and uncle, she definitely severed relations with the two, whom she now firmly believed had entered into a conspiracy to rob her of her all. The following day she ate her meals in the kitchen with Wong, to whom she confided her troubles. The old Chinaman listened intently until she was through. Then he arose and crossed the kitchen to a cupboard, a crafty smile playing over his wrinkled yellow countenance. "Me fixy, me no like 'em," he said, and he returned with a vial of white powder in his hand. "Oh, Wong, no, no," cried the girl, grasping instantly the faithful servitor's intent. "You mustn't do anything so horrible as that. Promise me that you won't."
"All lady, just say me you say,"
he replied with a shrug, and returned the file to the cupboard. "I'm going away tonight, Wong," she told him, "and I want you to promise me that nothing like that will happen while I'm away, and that you will stay until I return. There is no one else I could trust to look after the house."
"You come backy?"
"Yes, Wong. I'm going to Hendersville tonight so that I can catch the stage for Aldea in the morning. I'm going to take the train for Kansas City and consult some of Dad's friends and get them to recommend a good lawyer. You'll take care of things for me, Wong?"
"You bloody bloody."
That afternoon she sent for Hal Colby and told him what Corson had said to her. Colby seemed ill at ease and embarrassed.
"I'm mighty sorry, Di," he said, "but I don't see what you can do about it. If I was you, I'd accept half the purchase price. They got you dead to rights, and you won't make no money fighting them."
"Well, I won't accept it, and I'm surprised that you'd advise me to."
"It's only for your own good, Di," he assured her. "It ain't Lillian's fault that your uncle done your dad out in the property. You can't blame her for wanting what was left to her, and I think it was mighty pretty of her to offer to split with you."
"I don't," she replied, "and I think there's something behind that offer that is not apparent on the face of it. I'm going to find out, too. I'm going to Kansas City to hire a lawyer, and I'll want the buckboard and one of the men to drive me to town after supper tonight."
"I'm plumb sorry, Di, but Corson and Lillian have took the buckboard to town already."
"Then I'll go on Captain," she said. "Please have him saddled for me right after supper." She packed her traveling dress and other necessary articles in a small bag that could be tied to a saddle, leaving on her buckskin skirt and blouse for the ride to town, and after supper made her way to the corral after waiting a few minutes for Captain to be brought to the house and rather wondering why Hal had neglected to do so. To her surprise, she discovered that Captain had not even been saddled, and was, as a matter of fact, still running in the pasture a mile from the house. She went to the bunkhouse to get one of the men to catch him up, but found it deserted. From there she walked to the cookhouse, where she found only the cook setting bread for the morrow.
"Where are all the men?" she asked. "There's a dance to Johnson's tonight, and some of 'em went there," he told her.
"The rest went to town. Idaho, Shorty, and Pete went to the dance."
"Where's Hal?" "I reckon he went to town. I ain't seen him since this afternoon sometime."
"Did Willie go too?"
"No'm, he's here, Summers. Hey, Willie! You, Willie!"
Willie appeared from the outer dusk.
"Oh, Willie," said Diana, "won't you please catch Captain up for me and saddle him?"
"You ain't going to ride tonight all alone, be you?" he asked. "I've got to get to town, Willie, and Hal forgot to tell anyone to ride with me," she explained.
"Well, I'll go along with you," said Willie. "I'll have the hosses saddled pronto," and off he ran.
10 minutes later they were in the saddle and loping away through the rapidly falling night toward town. "I can't understand how Hal happened to let all the boys go at the same time," she said, half-musingly. "It was never done before, and it isn't safe."
"Bull wouldn't never have done it," said Willie. "Bull was a top-notch foreman."
"You like Bull?" she asked.
"You bet I do," declared Willie emphatically. "Don't you?"
"I like all the boys," she replied.
"Bull wouldn't never have left you here alone at night. He set a heap of store by you, miss."
Willie was emboldened to speak freely because of the darkness that would cover any sudden embarrassment he might feel if he went too far. The same darkness covered Diana's flush, a flush of contrition that she harbored a belief in Bull's villainy. Before they entered Hendersville, they became aware that something unusual was going on in town. They could hear the hum of excited voices, above which rose an occasional shout, and as they rode into the single street they saw 100 figures surging to and fro before Gum's place. A man stood on the veranda of the saloon, haranguing the crowd.
"This business has gone far enough," he was saying, as Diana and Willie paused at the outskirts of the crowd. "It's high time we put an end to it. You all knows who's a-doing it as well as I do. What we ought to do is ride out and get him tonight. There's a bunch of cottonwoods where he is, right handy, and we got plenty ropes in the cow country. Who's with me?"
20 voices yelled in savage assurance of their owner's hearty cooperation.
"Then get your broncs," cried the speaker, "and we'll go after him and get him."
Diana saw that the orator was Hal Colby. She turned to one of the men who was remaining as the majority of the others hastened after their ponies.
"What is it all about?" she asked. "What has happened?"
The man looked up at her, and as he recognized her, pulled his hat off awkwardly.
"Oh, it's you, Miss Henders. Well, you see, the stage was held up again today, and Mac Harbor was killed. It was his first trip since he was wounded that time. It was the first trip, too, since Bull quit guarding the gold, and a lot of the fellers have got it in their heads that it's Bull has done it."
"'Tain't no such thing," cried a little old man nearby. "'Tain't Bull."
The speaker was Wildcat Bob.
"I don't like to think so neither," said the first man, "but it sure looks bad for him. Them fellers is all head up. They ain't one in that crowd but what would lynch his grandma if he'd had another drink, and they sure have had plenty. Gum's been setting them up in there for a couple hours on the house. Never did see Gum so plumb liberal."
"He's aiming to get someone else to go after the Black Coyote," said Wildcat Bob, "or he wouldn't be so doggone liberal with his rot gut. He couldn't get up enough nerve if he'd drunk a whole distillery."
"You think they really intend to lynch Bull?" asked the girl.
"They ain't no two ways about it, miss," said the man she had first accosted.
"They're aiming to do it, and I reckon they will. You see, they're pretty sore. Mac tried to put up a little fight, and this Black Coyote feller bored him plumb between the eyes. Then he takes the gold, cuts all the horses loose from the stage, and vamooses. That's why we didn't hear of it till just a bit ago, 'cause they didn't have no way to get to town, only hoofing it."
Already the avenging mob was gathering. They came whooping, reeling in their saddles. Not one of them, sober, would have gone out after the ex-foreman of the Bar Y, but drunk, they forgot their fear of him, and Diana knew that they would carry out their purpose. They were going to lynch Bull. It seemed incredible, and yet, could she blame them? Knowing him as she did, she had herself half admitted the truth of the rumor of his guilt before this, the latest outrage that seemed to fix the responsibility beyond peradventure of a doubt. For the 6 weeks that Bull had guarded the bullion, there had been no hold-up, and now, on the very first stage day after he had been relieved, the depredations had been renewed. She recalled the fact that he had been seen with Gregorio on the very afternoon of a previous hold-up. She recalled the blood on his shirt that same day, the day that Mary Donovan had fired upon the bandits. She thought of the bag of gold dust that he had displayed at the bunkhouse. There seemed no possible avenue of escape from a belief in his guilt. The yelling avengers were milling around in a circle in front of Gum's place, firing off their guns, cursing, shouting. The sheriff appeared on the veranda and raised his hand for silence.
"I'm sheriff here," he said, "and as an arm of the law, I can't permit you all to go for to lynch nobody, but I can and do invite you all in to have a drink on the house before you go."
There was a wild shout of approval and a scramble for room at the tie rail. Those who lost out rode their ponies into the saloon, and as the last of them disappeared, Diana, who had lost sight of Willie in the jostle and excitement of the past few minutes, turned her pony about and rode back in the direction from which she had come. Just beyond the last house, she turned abruptly to the left. The Bar Y Ranch lay to the right. Urged Captain into a lope and started off through the darkness toward the west. Presently she struck a well-defined trail, and then with a word and a touch of her spurs she sent Captain into a run. Swiftly the wiry animal sprang through the night, while the beating of his mistress' heart kept time to the rapid fall of his unshod hoofs. What was she doing? Was she mad? A dozen times Diana Henders repeated those questions to herself, but the only answer was a monotonous cadence that beat upon her brain, reasonless, to the accompaniment of Captain's flying hoofs.
They shall not kill him. They shall not kill him. They shall not kill him.
Constantly she listened for sounds of the coming of the lynching party, though she knew that she had sufficient start to outdistance them completely, even had Captain not been the fleet and powerful runner that he was. It was 10 miles to the West Ranch from Hendersville, and the Captain made it in 30 minutes that night. Diana threw herself from the saddle at the gate and crawled through the bars, leaving Captain on wide-stretched feet and with nose to the ground blowing after his hard run, knowing that he would not move from the spot for some time. She hastened to the darkened cabin and pounded on the door.
"Bull," she cried, "Bull!" But there was no answer. Then she opened the door and entered. Fumbling around for a table, she found it and matches, striking one.
The cabin, a one-room affair, was empty, her ride for nothing. Bull was away, but they would hide in the brush and wait for him to come back, and then they would shoot him down in cold blood, and he would never have a chance for his life. If she only knew where he had gone, she might ride out and meet him, but she did not know. Wait, there was one chance. If he was the Black Coyote, he would doubtless come in from the north or the northeast, for in the latter direction lay Hell's Bend, the scene of his many holdups. But it wasn't Bull. It couldn't be Bull. Bull, of all the men in the world, could never have robbed her or killed her messenger.
Slowly she returned to Captain, standing with heaving sides and dilated nostrils. The animal staggered a bit as she mounted, but at a touch of the rein he turned and walked out into the sagebrush toward the north. She rode for a quarter of a mile, and then she reined in her mount and called the man's name aloud. There was no reply, and she turned to the east and rode in that direction for a while, now and then calling, "Bull!" her voice sounding strange and uncanny in her own ears. In the distance a coyote yapped and wailed.
She turned and rode west to a point beyond the cabin, and then back again, establishing a beat where she might hope to intercept the returning bull before he reached the danger of the ambush. At intervals she called his name aloud, and presently she halted frequently to listen for the coming of the lynchers. It was a matchless Arizona night. The myriad stars blazing in the blue-black vault of infinite space cast their radiance softly upon vale and height, relieving the darkness with a gentle luminosity that rendered distant objects discernible in mass, if not in form, and because of it, Diana saw the black bulk of the approaching horsemen while they were yet a considerable distance away, and, seeing them, dared not call Bull's name aloud again. The mob rode silently now, a grim and terrible shadow creeping through the darkness to lay bloody hands upon its prey. A quarter of a mile from the cabin it halted, while its members dismounted, and leaving a few to hold the horses, the balance crept stealthily forward on foot. Diana, too, had dismounted, knowing that she would be less conspicuous thus, and was leading Captain over a circuitous trail toward the north and east. The girl knelt and placed an ear to the ground. Faintly, as though at a great distance, she heard the rhythmic pounding of a horse's hooves. He was coming, loping through the night. Bull was coming, all unconscious of what awaited him there in the darkness. He was riding to his death. She hastened forward a short distance and listened again. If the sound should be plainer now, she would be sure that he was coming from the northeast. The self-appointed posse crept toward the cabin and, according to a general plan imparted to them by Colby, separated into two sections and surrounded it, finally worming their way close in on hands and knees, taking advantage of the cover of the sage to shield them from the sight of the man they believed to be there. Then Colby arose and walked boldly to the door. Knocking, he called Bull's name aloud. There was no response. "Hey, Bull," cried Colby again in a friendly voice. "It's Hal." Still no reply. Colby pushed the door open and entered. Of all the motley crew that followed him, he alone had the courage to do the thing he was doing now. He struck a match and lighted a candle that stood on the rude table, embedded in its own grease in the cover of a baking powder can. A brief survey of the interior showed him that it was untenanted. He extinguished the light and returned to his party, where word was passed around that they were to remain quietly in hiding where they were until the quarry came. In the meantime, a lone horseman had thrown himself from a half-spent pony in the Barwai ranch yard, and seeing a light in the cookhouse, had burst in upon the astonished cook.
"What in all tarnation's the matter of ye, Wildcat Bob?" he demanded. "Where's Bull?" asked the little old man. "Reckon he's over at the West Ranch. Leastways, there's where he's supposed to be. Why? Weren't there a gang of the boys just here looking for him?"
"No."
A burst of lurid profanity filled the room as Wildcat Bob explained just how he felt and what he thought of himself.
"They set out to lynch Bull," he explained finally, "and I, supposing of course that he was here, got away ahead of him, and now, dingbust mournery old carcass, like as not they already got him over at the West Ranch. Where's the rest of the boys?
Where's Texas Pete? You don't reckon that critter's with Colby, do you?"
"Not by a long shot," replied the cook. "He'd stick up for Bull if he massacred the whole darn county.
So'd Shorty in Idaho, but they ain't none of 'em here. They's all down to Johnson's to a dance."
"Well," said Wildcat Bob, "I done my best, which same ain't no good. If I had a hoss instead of a hunk of coyote fodder, I'd try to get to the West Ranch in time, but I reckon they ain't no chance now. Howsomever, I'll do the best I can. So long," and he was gone.
A half hour later, his horse fell dead a mile north of Hendersville, while his rider was taking a short cut straight across country for the West Ranch. It was a warm and lurid Wildcat Bob who plodded through the dust of Hendersville's lone thoroughfare and stopped at the veranda of the Donovan House some time later to be accosted by one of the group gathered there in semi-silent expectancy.
"The saints be praised," exclaimed Mary Donovan. "Is it a banshee or is it not?"
"It's worse," said Bill Gatlin, the stage driver. "It's Wildcat Bob, walkin'."
"Did they get the poor boy?" demanded Mary, whereat the little old gentleman burst forth anew with such a weird variety of oaths that Mr. Jefferson Wainwright Jr. could feel the hot flush that mounted to his ears fairly scorching his skin.
"If I ever gets hold of the blankety-blank-blank that loaned me that blankety-blank-blank ewe-necked, ring-boned, spavined excuse for a cayuse, I'll cut his heart out," announced Wildcat Bob in a high falsetto. Finally, Mary Donovan unveiled the facts from him.
"You done well, Bob, that you did," she assured him. "Sure, and how was yeast to know that he wasn't at the home ranch?"
"I shouldn't think you'd care if they did hang a bandit and a murderer," declared Mr. Jefferson Wainwright Jr.
"Who in hell told you to think, you darn dude?" screamed Wildcat Bob, reaching for his gun. Mr. Wainwright sought the greater safety of the office, tipping over his chair and almost upsetting Mary Donovan in his haste. "Don't shoot," he cried. "Don't shoot. I meant no offense." Wildcat Bob would have followed him within, but Mary Donovan caught him round the waist and pushed him into a chair. "Be calm, Robert," she soothed him.
As Diana arose to her feet, after listening close to the ground for the second time, she was assured by the increased loudness of the sounds she had heard that the lone rider was rapidly approaching from the northeast, and in that direction she again led Captain, intending to dismount once more as soon as she had reached what she considered a safe distance from the cabin and the hidden watchers encircling it. She had forged ahead for about 5 minutes when the way dipped into a shallow swale in which the sagebrush grew to greater size.
Here would be a good place to remount, and with this intention crystallized, she wound downward among the scattered brush toward the bottom, when, rounding a particularly high bush, she came suddenly face to face with a man leading a horse.
"Stick 'em up,"
whispered the man in a low voice, presenting an evil-looking six-gun at the pit of her stomach. "Oh, bull," she cried in low tones, for she would have known his voice among thousands. "You," he cried. "My God, miss, what are you doing here?"
"They've come to lynch you, bull," she told him. "There are 40 or 50 of them lying in the brush around your cabin now. They say that you held up the stage and killed Mac Harper today."
"And you came to warn me?" His voice sounded far away, as though, groping for a truth he could not grasp, he spoke half to himself. "You must go away, bull," she told him. "You must leave the country." He paid no attention to her words. "I seen a light flash for a minute in the shack," he said, "and so I reckoned I'd have a look around before I came too close. That's why I was walking when I hearn you. I was just a-going to leave Blazes here and go ahead and scout around a bit. Mount up now and I'll take you home." "No," she said, "you get away. I can get home all right. I only have to go to town. I'm stopping at Mary's tonight." "I'll ride with you," he insisted. She knew him well enough to know that he would never let her ride to town alone through the night, and so she mounted as he did, and together they followed the swale which ran in the general direction of Hendersville. "You say you're stopping at Mary's?" he asked. "Just for tonight. I'm taking the stage for Aldea in the morning. I'm going to Kansas City to consult a lawyer. They are trying to take the property away from me, bull." And then she told him all that had transpired since yesterday. "You don't need a lawyer, miss," he told her. "What you need is a two-gun man, only you don't need him because you got one already. You go back to the ranch, and come morning there won't be any dude or dudess to try to put their brand on nothing that belongs to you." "Oh, bull, don't you understand that you mustn't do anything like that?" she cried. "It would only make things worse than they are now. Wong wanted to poison them." "Good old Wong," interjected bull. "But we can't make murderers of ourselves just because they are wicked. It ain't murder to kill a rattlesnake," he reminded her. "But promise me that you won't," she urged. "I wouldn't do nothing you didn't want done, miss," he said. They were nearing town now, and could see the lights plainly, shining through the windows and doorways. "You better go now, bull," she said. "Not till I get you in town safe," he replied. "But I'm safe now. It is only a little way, and I'm afraid they might get you if you came in." "Shucks, they won't get me now that I know they're after me," he replied. "Say, miss," he exclaimed suddenly, "you ain't asked me if it was me that killed Mac." She drew herself up proudly. "I'll never ask you, bull," she said. "But you wouldn't have come out to warn me if you'd thought it," he suggested. She was silent for a moment, and then, "Yes, I would, bull," she said, in a very little voice. He shrugged his shoulders. "As I told Pete, if I had done it or if I hadn't done it, I'd say I hadn't, so what's the use to wasting breath? But I sure appreciates what you done, miss." "And you will go away?" she asked. "No, I'll stay here. I reckon you need me, miss, from what you've told me, so I'll hang around a spell. I'll ride over to the ranch a nights now and then. If you happen to hear a meadow lark setting up late after dark, you'll know it's me." "But I'm afraid they'll get you, bull, if you stay in the country. They're terribly angry," she warned. "They won't be so keen to find me after they're sobered up a bit," he said with a smile. "Colby's the only one that's got the nerve to go again guns single-handed." "I don't see why he hates you so," she said. "I used to think that he liked you." "Then all I got to say, miss, is that you must be plumb blind," said bull. Diana was evidently not so blind as he thought her, for she flushed deliciously. "Now you must turn back," she said. They were almost in town. "I will, because they mustn't see you riding in with me," he replied. She reined in her horse and held out her hand to him. "Goodbye, bull," she said. He took her slim hand and his and pressed it strongly. "Goodbye, Diana," said bull. She spoke to Captain and moved off toward the little town, and the man sat there in the darkness watching her retreating form until it was hidden behind a corner of the Donovan house. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 14. Bull Sees Colby. Bull turned Blaze's head toward the northeast and rode off slowly in the direction of Coyote Canyon, near the head of which there was a wild and almost inaccessible country just east of Hell's Bend Pass. There was water there and game for himself, with year-round pasture for Blaze's. As he rode, he hummed a gay little air, quite unlike the grim, taciturn bull that his acquaintances knew, for bull was happy, happier than he had been for months. "And to think," he mused, "that she rode out there all alone to warn me. Bull," says she, "I don't love any man, bull, that way. But if ever I do, he'll know it without my telling him. I'll do something that will prove it. A girl always does." "That's what she says, them's her very words. I ain't never forgot 'em, and I ain't never going to, even if I don't believe it. It was just her good heart that sent her out to warn me. She'd have done as much for any of the boys." When Diana reined in before those assembled on the veranda of the Donovan house, she was greeted by a gasp of astonishment from Mary Donovan. "Diana Henders, child," she exclaimed, "what are you doing here this time of night?
Sure, and I thought you'd gone back to the ranch, after hearing you was in town earlier in the evening.
Diana dismounted without making any reply and tied Captain to the rail in front of the hotel. As she mounted the steps to the veranda, the younger Wainwright rose politely. Corson and the elder Wainwright nodded, the latter grunting gruffly. Lillian Mannell pretended that she did not see her.
"I'm going to stop here tonight, Mrs. Donovan," said Diana to the proprietress.
"That is, if you have room for me."
"And if I didn't, I'd be after making it," replied the latter. "I wonder if you'd mind putting Captain up for me, Bob,"
said Diana, turning to the wildcat, and as the old man stepped from the veranda to comply with her request, Diana turned and entered the office, followed by Mary Donovan.
"May I have a cup of tea, Mrs. Donovan?" asked the girl. "I feel all fagged out.
This evening has been like a terrible nightmare."
"You mean about poor Bull?" asked Mary.
Diana nodded.
"They ain't back yet," said Mary,
"but I suppose they got him. Bad cess to him." Diana came closer to the older woman and whispered,
"They didn't get him. I just saw him. He brought me to the edge of town." "Now the Lord be praised for that," ejaculated Mary Donovan.
"For sure, and if it's guilty he is, I'll not be after believing it at all.
"It looks pretty bad for him, Mrs. Donovan," said Diana.
"But even so, I can't believe it of him either. I won't believe it."
"Ain't no more don't yees, darling," advised Mary Donovan. "And now make yourself comfortable, and I'll have ye a cup of tea in no time."
As her hostess left the sitting room by one doorway, Jefferson Wainwright, Jr. appeared in the other, which opened from the office, his hat in his hand.
"May I have just a word with you, Miss Henders?" he asked.
The girl nodded her assent, though none too cordially, and Wainwright entered the little sitting room.
"I can't begin to tell you, Miss Henders," he commenced after clearing his throat, "how badly I feel over this matter that Mr. Corson has explained to us. There isn't any question, of course, about the unfairness and injustice of it. But the fact remains that the law is the law, and I don't see how you are going to get around it by fighting them."
"It is a matter, Mr. Wainwright, that I do not care to discuss with you," said Diana, rising.
"Wait a minute, Miss Henders," he begged. "That wasn't exactly what I wanted to discuss with you, though it has a bearing on it. There is a way out for you, and it was that I wanted to talk over. Your father was a wealthy man. You've been accustomed to everything that money could buy in this country. To drop from affluence to penury in a single day is going to be mighty hard for you, and it is that I wanted to save you from."
"It is very kind of you, I am sure," she told him, "but I cannot see how you, of all people, can help me, for your own father is a party to this whole transaction."
"I think you are a bit hard on him," he said. "You surely cannot blame him for wanting to drive as good a bargain as possible. He is, first and last, a businessman."
Diana only shrugged her shoulders.
"Now, as I said," continued Mr. Wainwright, "there is a way for you to continue to have not only the luxuries you have been accustomed to, but many more, and at the same time to retain the Barwy Ranch."
She looked up at him questioningly. "Yes," she said, "and how?"
"By marrying me, Miss Henders. You know I love you. You know there is nothing I would not do for you. There is no sacrifice that I would not willingly and gladly make for you. I would die for you, dear girl, and thank God for the chance."
Diana Henders' lip curled in scorn. "It seems to me that I heard you make that very assertion once before, Mr. Wainwright, and in those self-same words. The night before you ran away, like the coward you are, and left us at the mercy of the Apaches. If you had half the courage that you had effrontery, the lion would appear a mouse by comparison. Please never mention the subject to me again, nor is there any reason why you should ever address me upon any subject. Good night."
"You'll regret this," he cried as he was leaving the room. "You see if you don't. You might have had one friend, and a good one, on your side. Now you haven't any. We'll strip you to the last cent for this, and then you'll marry some ignorant, unwashed cowpuncher and raise brats in a tumble-down shack for the rest of your life. That's what you'll do."
"And do you know what you'll do?" demanded a squeaky voice behind him. Jefferson Wainwright, Jr. turned to see Wildcat Bob glaring at him from the center of the office floor. The young man turned a sickly hue and glanced hurriedly for an avenue of escape, but the wildcat was between him and the outer doorway and was reaching for one of his terrible guns. With a half-stifled cry, Wainwright sprang into the sitting room and ran to Diana. Seizing her, he whirled the girl about so that she was between him and the wildcat's weapon.
"My God, Miss Henders, don't let him shoot me. I'm unarmed. It would be murder. Save me. Save me."
His screams brought his father, Corson, Lillian Mannell, and Mary Donovan to the room, where they saw the younger Wainwright kneeling in abject terror behind Diana's skirts.
"What's the meaning of all this?" yelled the elder Wainwright.
"Your son insulted me. He asked to marry me," said Diana. "Let him go, Bob," she directed the wildcat.
"Gosh a'mighty, miss," exclaimed the old man in an aggrieved tone. "You don't mean it, do you? Why, I'd just been honing for a chance to clean up this here whole bunch of tin horns, and now that I got an excuse, it don't seem right to let it pass. By cracky, it ain't right. Tain't moral, that's what it ain't."
"Please, Bob, I've got trouble enough. Let him go." Slowly, Wildcat Bob returned his gun to its holster, shaking his head mournfully, and Jefferson Wainwright, Jr. arose and sneaked out of the room. As his party returned to the veranda, the young man's father was growling and spluttering in an undertone, but Wildcat Bob caught the words law and sheriff.
"What's that?" he demanded in his high falsetto.
The elder Wainwright cringed and stepped rapidly through the doorway.
"Nothing," he assured the wildcat. "I didn't calculate to say nothing at all."
It was almost morning when the weary and now sobered members of the necktie party returned to town. Gum Smith, and several others, among whom was Wildcat Bob, met them in the street. "Get him?" demanded the sheriff. "No," replied Colby, "and I don't savvy it neither. Someone must have put him wise, but I got some evidence," and he drew a worn leather pouch from his shirt. "Here's one of the bullion bags that was took from the stage yesterday. I found it under his blankets. He may have been there and saw us coming, but that ain't likely, 'cause we snuck up mighty careful. Someone must have put him wise."
"I wonder who all it could have been," wondered Gum Smith.
As the crowd was dispersing, Wildcat Bob caught sight of Willie among them.
"Hey there, you," he called. "What was you doing with that bunch? I thought you claimed to be a friend of Bull's."
"Course I am," maintained Willie stoutly, "but I ain't never seed no one hanged." A few hours later, Diana Henders left on the stage for Aldea, and after she had departed, Corson and Lillian Mantle drove back to the ranch, taking the Wainwrights with them, while Hal Colby trotted along beside them. He had not seen Diana before she left, nor had he made any effort to do so.
"We might save a right smart of trouble if we could get everything fixed up before she gets back, Corson," the elder Wainwright was saying. "The government patent to the land as well as Mantle's will are in the New York office," replied Corson. "I've sent for them.
They ought to be along now any time. I rather expected them on yesterday's stage. They certainly must come in on the next, and I imagine she won't get back for a week at least. That will give us 3 days. Then we'll all go to Aldea, have the papers drawn up there. You turn the money over to us and Miss Mantle, and I can get away for New York on the train that night. I've had all this damn country I want." Hal Colby, fortunately for his peace of mind, did not overhear the conversation. It outlined an entirely different plan from that which Lillian Mantle had explained to him only the preceding day, a plan which included a hasty wedding and a long honeymoon, during which the barwife foreman would taste the sweets of world travel in company with a charming and affectionate bride.
"You're going to leave me here to run all the risk, eh?" demanded Wainwright Sr.
"Oh, there's no risk now that bullfeller is out of the way," Corson assured him.
"I wish I was sure he was out of the way," said Wainwright dubiously. "I don't like that fellow a little bit."
"He'll never show up again," said Corson, confidently. "And anyway, just as soon as I can get to New York, I'll look up a good man to represent me here, and I'm going to pick the toughest one I can find in New York, too."
"I'm afraid I'm buying a heap of trouble with that one-third interest of mine," said Wainwright, scratching his head.
"But look what you're going to get out of it," Corson reminded him. "I'll bet we take a million out of that mine in the next year." Back at the ranch, Colby was met by a scowling trio, Texas Pete, Shorty, and Idaho. "Where's Bull?" demanded Texas.
"How should I know?" replied Colby, gruffly. "When was I elected as nurse girl?"
"You went out after him with a bunch of drunken shorthorns last night," accused Shorty. "You know whether you got him or not."
"They didn't get him," said Colby shortly.
"It's a damn good thing for you, Colby, that they didn't," said Texas Pete. "And another thing, we wants our time. We ain't aiming to work under no polecat no more."
"I reckon we can get along without you," retorted Colby, ignoring the insult. "You can come back in a week for your checks. The boss ain't here."
"Then we'll stay till she is," said Pete.
"Suit yourselves," replied Colby as he turned and walked away.
The routine of the ranch moved in its accustomed grooves as the days passed, though there was noticeably absent the spirit of good fellowship that marks the daily life of a well-ordered cow outfit. A little coterie, headed by Texas Pete, herded by itself in the vernacular of the West, while the remaining punchers grouped themselves about the foreman. Mealtimes, ordinarily noisy with rough but good-natured badinage, had become silent moments to be gotten through with as rapidly as possible. There was a decorous restraint that was far too decorous among these rough men to augur aught of good. It revealed rather than veiled the proximity of open hostilities. There was one topic of conversation that was eschewed particularly. It would have been the steel to the flint of prejudice which lay embedded in the powder of partisanship. Bull's name was never mentioned when the factions were together. The stage came again to Hendersville on the third day after Diana's departure. It brought mail for the ranch, but the vaquero who had been sent from the Bar Y for it tarried longer at Gum's place, liquors and cigars, than he intended, with the result that it was well after supper and quite dark before he delivered it to the office. As he approached the yellow rectangle of the open office door, it may have been the light shining in his eyes that prevented him from seeing the figure of a man beneath the darkness of the cottonwoods that surrounded the house, or the horse, standing as silently as its master, 50 feet away, a blazed-faced chestnut with two white hind feet. The vaquero entered the office, where Corson was sitting in conversation with the two Wainwrights, and laid the mail upon the table. The New Yorker picked it up and ran through it. There was a bulky letter addressed to him, which he opened. "Here's what we've been waiting for," he said, glancing quickly through two enclosures and laying them aside to peruse the accompanying letter. The man beneath the shadows of the cottonwoods moved closer to the open office doorway, keeping well out of the yellow shaft of lamplight. Bull had not come down to the Bar Y from his hiding place in Coyote Canyon for the purpose of spying upon Corson. He had hoped against hope that Diana might return on the day's stage, for he wanted a word with her. He knew that she could not have made the trip to Kansas City and returned in so short a time, but then she might have changed her mind at Aldea and given up the trip. It was on this chance that he had come down out of the mountains tonight. Diana had not returned. He had convinced himself of this, but still he tarried. These were her enemies. It could do no harm to keep an eye on them. He did not like the proprietorial airs of Corson sitting there in the old man's easy chair, and as for the Wainwrights, they too seemed much more at home than suited Bull. His hand caressed the butt of a six-gun affectionately.
"Hell!" exclaimed Corson explosively. "The addle-brained idiot!"
"What's the matter?" inquired the elder Wainwright. Corson was in the midst of the letter. He shook it violently and angrily in lieu of anything more closely representative of its writer. "The chump has dug up some papers that we don't want. We don't want him in Arizona at all. He's a new man. I thought he had good sense and discretion, but he hasn't either. He's sending them out here by registered mail.
If anything happens to them, if they fall into the Henders girl's hands, our goose is cooked.
He says they put a new aspect on the situation, and that he knows I'll be delighted to have them. They surely will put a new aspect on the situation, but I don't want him, not here. If I'd had any sense, I'd have destroyed them before I left New York, but who'd have thought that they weren't safe right in my own office? I'd be delighted to have him, by the neck. Lord, suppose they're lost now. They should have been here with this other mail."
"If it's registered stuff, it may have been delayed just enough to miss the stage at Aldea by one train," suggested Wainwright. "If that is the case, it'll be along by the next stage."
"What were the papers?" demanded the elder Wainwright suspiciously. Corson hesitated. He realized that he'd been surprised by his anger into saying too much. "Perhaps I overestimate their value," he said. "They might not do any harm, after all."
"What were they?" insisted Mr. Wainwright.
"Oh, they were reports that show the tremendous value of the new vein in the mine," lied Corson, glibly. Wainwright sank back in his chair with a sigh of relief. "Oh, if that's all they was, we don't need to worry none about them," he said. "We as good as got the place now. We'll drive over to Aldea tomorrow and fix things up, eh?"
"I think I'll wait for the next mail," said Corson. "Those reports might not do any harm, but I'd rather be here when they come and see that no one else gets hold of them."
"Maybe you're right," assented Wainwright. He rose, yawning, and stretched. "I calculate to go to bed," he said.
"I think I'll do the same," said his son. "I hope Miss Mantle is feeling better by morning."
"Oh, she'll be all right," said Corson. "Just a little headache. Good night. I'm coming along, too." They lighted lamps, blew out the one in the office, and departed for their rooms. The man in the shadows turned slowly toward his horse, but he had taken only a few steps when he halted, listening. Someone was approaching. He glanced through the darkness in the direction of the sounds which came out of the night along the pathway from the bunkhouse. Stepping quickly behind the bole of a large tree, Bull waited in silence. Presently he saw dimly the figure of a man, and as it came nearer, the starlight revealed its identity. It was Colby. Like himself, Colby waited in the shadows of the trees, waited silently, watching the dead black of the office windows. The silence was tangible. It was so absolutely dominant, reigning supreme in a world of darkness. Bull wondered that the other did not hear his breathing. He marveled at the quietness of Blazes. Even the roller in his bit lay silent. But it could not last much longer. The horse was sure to move in a moment, and Colby would investigate. The result was a foregone conclusion. There would be shooting. Bull did not want to shoot Colby. Not now. There were two reasons. One, however, would have been enough, that Diane Henders was thinking of marrying this man. And then the silence was broken. Very slightly only it was broken. A suspicion of a sound came from the interior of the house, and following it, a dim light wavering mysteriously upon the office walls, growing steadily brighter until the room was suddenly illuminated. From where he now stood, Bull could not see the interior of the office, but he knew that someone carrying a lamp had come down the stairway, along the hall, and entered the office. Then he saw Colby move forward and step lightly to the veranda, and an instant later the office door swung open, revealing Lillian Mantle in diaphanous negligee. Bull saw Colby seize the girl, strain her to him, and cover her lips with kisses. Then the girl drew her lover into the room and closed the door. With a grimace of disgust, Bull walked to Blazes, mounted him, and rode slowly away. Now there was only one reason why he could not kill Colby yet. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 15. Now, go. It was Wednesday again. Four horses, sweat-streaked, toiled laboriously to drag the heavy coach up the north side of Hell's Bend Pass. It was a tough pull, even with a light load, one that really demanded six horses and would have had six in the old days, and today the load was light. There was but a single passenger. She sat on the driver's box with Bill Gatlin, with whom she was in earnest discussion. "I tell you, I don't believe he did it," she was saying. "I'll never believe that he did it, and I'm mighty glad that he got away." Gatlin shook his head. "There ain't no one got a better right to say that than you has, miss," he said. "For 'twas your gold as was stole, and your messengers was shot up. But nevertheless, and howsomever, I've got my own private opinion, what I'm keeping to myself, that it was Bull all right as done it." "I'd just like to see this black coyote once," said the girl. "I'd know if it was Bull or not." "They ain't no chance today, miss," Gatlin told her. "They ain't no gold shipment today, unless I'm mighty mistook."
"Don't he ever make a mistake?" asked the girl.
"Never hain't yet, miss." Diana relapsed into silence, her thoughts reverting to her interview with the Kansas City attorney. He had not held out very roseate hopes.
By means of litigation, long and expensive, she might, after a number of years, get a small portion of her father's share of the business. She had better take a cash settlement, if she could get one, he thought. $125,000 in the hand would be much better, in his opinion, than a long drawn-out lawsuit that could be nothing better than an expensive gamble with the odds against her. But I won't. I won't. I won't be robbed, she ejaculated beneath her breath. How's that, miss? Inquired Bill Gatlin. Was you speaking to me? I must have been thinking out loud, she said, smiling. What a long pull this is, Bill. We're nigh to the summit, he replied, pulling in his team to breathe them for a moment. On the shoulder of Wagon Mountain, overlooking the south stretch of Hell's Bend Pass Road, two men sat their horses amidst the clump of chaparral that effectually hid them from the road, though they could see nearly its entire length from the summit to the gap at the bottom. Presently one of them spoke. Here it comes, he said. He was a swarthy, powerfully built Mexican, somewhere in his 30s, Gregorio, the bandit. His companion was adjusting a black silk handkerchief across his face in such a way as to entirely hide his features. There were two small holes cut in the handkerchief opposite its wearer's eyes, which, through them, were fixed upon the stage as it topped the pass and started downward upon its rapid and careening descent toward the gap and Handersville. Come, said Gregorio, and wheeled his horse about. His companion's mount moved suddenly before the handkerchief was finally adjusted, and as the man reached for his reins, the thing fell away from his face, revealing it. It was Bull. A second attempt was more successful, and then the men rode down the sheer mountainside, keeping just below the crest upon the south side and hidden from the view of the driver and the passenger upon the stage. Their horses moved with extreme care and without haste, for the way was precarious, occasionally requiring that the horses sit upon their haunches and slide for short distances until they found footing again further down. The riders seemed unperturbed either by the dangers of the descent or fear of being late at their rendezvous, suggesting habitude with the work in hand. In a dense growth of scrub just above the gap, they tied their horses, continuing on foot. The stage lumbered downward, rocking from side to side. Diana held tight and said nothing. She had ridden with Bill Gatlin before, many times. He glanced at her out of the corner of an eye. This ain't nothing, he said, as though in answer to a remonstrance on her part. Diana knew what was coming. She had heard it many times. No siree, continued Bill, this ain't nothing. Why, you ought to been with me one night when I was on the Denver run in the old days, afore the railroads spoiled the country. The trails crossed plumb over the top of a mountain. 'Tweren't no road. 'Tweren't nothing but a trail. I held the old stage plumb full and passengers a-hanging on to the boot. It was pitch dark, the doggonest, darkest night I ever see. Couldn't see ary wheel horse. Only ways I knowed I had any horses was when their shoes struck fire on the stony parts of the road. Just afore we struck the top of the mountain, there was the worst cloud bust I ever did see. Them horses had to swim the last 100 rods to the top of that mountain, and the old stage was bobbing around so on the waves that 8 of the passengers got seasick. But that wa'n't nothing. When we came to the top, I found the road had been all washed away. There wa'n't no more road than a jackrabbit. But I was a-carrying the mail, just like I be now, and I had to get through. It was a high mountain and tolerably steep, but not no trees. So I see there wa'n't only one thing to do, and that was to go down, road or no road. So right there on top of that mountain, I threw the leather into him and headed him for Denver, and down we goes faster than ever I rid afore or since. The wheelers a-jumping to keep out of the way of the stage, and the leaders a-jumping to keep out of the way of the wheelers. Well, sir, we was going so fast that the first thing I knowed, the friction had melted the nut off in the nigh front wheel, and away went that wheel hell-bent for election down the mountain. But it couldn't keep up with the stage, and pretty soon it was left behind, but the stage was going so fast that it never missed that wheel at all. And pretty soon off came the off-rear wheel, and that wheel couldn't keep up, though I see it was doing its best out in the corner of my eye. Well, sir, 'twa'n't long for the t'other hind wheel come off, but we was going about twice as fast now as when the first wheel come off, and that old stage just skimmed along on one wheel, a dinged sight smoother than it ever done on 4. When we were about to the bottom, off come the last wheel, and then thinks I for sure we gotta quit, and we ain't to Denver yet. But we'd got so much momentum by this time that the last wheel didn't make no more difference than the others. Them horses just drug that stage out behind them like the comet does its tail, and on we went, streaking down that mountain and 5 mile out onto the flat before the stage hit the ground, and then, of course, we had to stop. It was too bad. I tell you, I felt plumb sore. I hadn't never been off schedule since I took the run.
Then, all of a sudden, says one of the passengers, "Look back yonder, Bill," says he. "Look what's coming." And I looked, and there come them 4 wheels a-tearing across the flat straight for us.
Well, to make a long story short, they peters out right beside the stage, and with the help of the passengers and some extra nuts, we got 'em back on where they belonged and pulled into Denver 2 hours ahead of time. But I tell you, miss, that was some ride. I'd hate to have to take it again. Why?
Hands up. Put 'em up.
The stage had slowed down for the rough road through the gap, when 2 men with muffled faces stepped before the leaders, covering the driver and his lone passenger with wicked-looking 6 guns. Diana Henders sat as one turned to stone, her eyes fixed upon the tall, fine figure of the leading highwayman.
A little gust of wind moved the handkerchief that covered his face so that she saw, or she thought that she saw, a scar upon the square chin. She was not afraid. It was not fear, physical fear, that held her motionless. It was worse than that. It was the paralyzing terror of the heart and soul.
Was it Bull? Could it be Bull? But, dear God, could she be mistaken in the familiar lines of that figure? Every movement, every gesture proclaimed the numbing truth.
He had not spoken. She was glad of that, for she wanted something upon which to hang it out. The second man had given the brief commands. That he was Gregorio, she had no doubt. "Throw down the mail pouch," he commanded, and Bill Gatlin threw it down. The taller man took it and went to the rear of the stage, out of sight. 5 minutes later, Gregorio commanded them to drive on. That was all. The thing had not consumed 6 minutes, but in that brief time the structure of Diana's life had been shaken to its foundations. A new, a terrible truth had engulfed her. A truth that should have upborne her upon a wave of exaltation and happiness now dragged her down into the vortex of a whirlpool of self-loathing and misery. They rode on in silence for a few minutes, Bill Gatlin cracking his long whip above the ears of the leaders, galloping smoothly over a comparatively level road.
"Doggone," he said presently. "It's getting too almighty regular to suit me, though I reckon as how I might get lonesome if I wasn't held up once in a while. But you had your wish, miss. You got to see the black coyote, all right. And now what do you think? Is it or isn't it Bull?"
Diana Henders bit her lip. "Of course it was not Bull," she said.
"Looked powerful like him to me," said Gatlin.
As they drew up in front of the Donovan house, the usual idlers came forth to learn what new element this, their sole link to civilization, had infused into their midst. They greeted Diana nonetheless cordially because she was the only passenger and the stage had brought no new interest to Hendersville. "Held up again," announced Bill. "Some on you better go and tell Gum. He might want to deputize someone." Immediately the crowd was interested. They asked many questions.
"They wa'n't much to it," said Bill Gatlin. "Being as how they wa'n't no gold, he took the mail.
I reckon if you was looking for any letters, you won't get 'em." A man from the Bar Y spoke up.
"That New York feller up to the ranch was looking for an important piece of mail," he said. "He sent me down special to get it."
"Hey, what's this?" demanded another, peering into the interior of the coach.
"Here's your mail bag, Bill, a-lying right in here."
He dragged it out and exhibited to the others.
"Is something wrong with it? It's been cut open," said another, pointing to a slit in the leather.
Then the postmaster came up and rescued the sack. The crowd followed him to the general store in which the post office was conducted. Here the postmaster, assisted by the crowd, went through the contents of the sack.
"Course I can't tell what's missing," he said, "only they ain't no registered letter for Mr. Corson."
Diana Henders had gone immediately into the Donovan house as quickly as she could clamber from the stage after it had come to a stop, and Mary Donovan had taken her into the privacy of her sitting room for the cup of tea that Diana had been looking forward to for the past couple of hours. Here she told the motherly Irish woman the details of her trip to Kansas City and the quandary she was in as to what procedure to follow in her future dealings with Corson. "If I had anything to fight with, I'd fight," she exclaimed, "but I'm all alone. Even the law seems to be on their side, against justice."
"Sure, and it's not all alone ye are," Mary Donovan assured her. "What would all the friends ye have that would fight for ye at the drop of a hat? Faith, they'd run them tin horns out of the country, and ye give the word."
"I know," assented the girl, "and I appreciate what the boys would do for me, but it can't be done that way. Dad always stood for law and order, and it wouldn't do for me to sponsor illegal methods."
"You've got to fight the devil with fire," said Mary.
Diana made no reply. She sat sipping her tea, her expression one of troubled sadness, but she was not thinking of those who would take her property from her, nor of their unfair methods. Mary Donovan was moving about the room tidying up. Diana set her empty cup upon the rickety center table which supported an oil lamp, a Bible, a red plush photograph album, and a gilded conch shell, and sighed. Mrs. Donovan glanced at her out of the corner of an eye and guessed shrewdly that there was something more than New Yorkers troubling her. Presently she came and stood in front of the girl.
"What is it, Mavourneen?" she asked.
"Be after telling Mary Donovan." Diana rose, half turned her head away, and bit her lower lip in an effort to hide or suppress a short, quick intaking of the breath that was almost a gasp. "The stage was held up again today," she said, mastering herself and turning, wide-eyed, toward the older woman.
"I saw them. I saw them both."
"Yes," said Mary Donovan.
"But it wasn't he. It wasn't Mary Donovan." And Diana, throwing herself upon the broad, motherly bosom, burst into tears, through which she gasped an occasional, "It wasn't! It wasn't!"
"Sure now, it wasn't," soothed Mary. "And the first one that'll be after saying it was, wish he'd never been born. And even if it was, Diana Henders, there's many a good man's gone wrong and come right again."
"Why, look at that old fool Wildcat Bob. They do be saying he was a road agent hisself 30 years ago, and he's killed so many men he's lost count of them, he has. But now look at him. A quiet and peaceable old man, and a good citizen when he ain't full of barbed wire, which ain't often."
Diana dried her tears through a smile. "You're very fond of Bob, aren't you?" she asked.
"Run along with you now," exclaimed Mary Donovan, smiling coyly.
I think Bob would make you a good husband, continued Diana, and you really need a man around here. Why don't you marry him? I know he's anxious enough.
Marry him, indeed, sniffed Mary. The old fool's stricken dumb every time he's alone with me. If ever he's married it is, it's the girl that'll be having to pop the question.
They were interrupted by a rap on the sitting room door. It was the vaquero from the Bar Y who had come down for the mail.
Bill Gatlin told me you was here, miss, he said. Do you want me to tell Colby to send the buckboard down for you?
I left Captain here, thanks, replied Diana, and as soon as I can change my clothes, I'll ride back to the ranch.
Shall I wait for you? He inquired.
No, thanks. I don't know how long I'll be, she told him. But if Pete is there, you might ask him to ride out and meet me. A half hour later, Diana rode out of Hendersville on Captain along the winding, dusty road bordered by interminable sage and greasewood that stretched off in undulating billows of rolling land to the near mountains on the north and away to the south as far as the eye could reach, where the softened outline of other mountains rose, mysterious, through the haze. The low sun cast long shadows toward the east. Those of herself and her mount transformed into a weird creature of Brobdingnagian proportions, mincing along upon preposterous legs. The inhabitants of a prairie dog village watched her approach with growing suspicions, scampering at last to the safety of their catacombian retreat, all but a single patriarch and two owls who watched her from the safe proximity of burrow mouths until she had passed. Drear and desolate the aspect of the scene, perhaps, but to Diana it was home, and a tear came to her eye as she thought that in a day or a week she might be leaving it forever. Her home. And they were driving her away from it, stealing it from her. Her home that her father had built for her mother, that he had planned that Diana should have after he had gone. The wickedness of it. The injustice. That was what rankled. The injustice. She dashed away the tear with an angry gesture. She would not be dispossessed. She would fight. Mary Donovan was right. It was no sin to fight the devil with fire. It was at this moment that she saw a horseman approaching her from the direction of the ranch. Her eyes, long accustomed to keen observation into vast expanses, recognized the man minutes before his features were discernible, and a little cloud crossed her brow. It was not Texas Pete, as she had hoped, but Hal Colby. Perhaps it was for the best. She would have to see him sometime and tell him. As he approached her, she saw that there was no welcoming smile on his face, which wore a troubled expression, but his greeting was cordial.
"Hello, Di," he cried. "Why didn't you let me know you was coming today?"
"There was no way to let you know, of course," she replied. "You might have guessed that I would be back as soon as I could."
"Tom just got in from town and told me you was coming. I hurried out to head you off. You don't want to come to the ranch now. It wouldn't be no ways pleasant for you."
"Why?" she demanded. "The Wainwrights are there for one thing," he said, drawing rein in front of her. She set her firm little jaw and rode around him. "I am going home," she said. "I wouldn't be foolish, Di," he insisted. "It'll only make more trouble. They as good as got the place now. We can't fight 'em. It wouldn't get us nowheres."
"Let me see what I can get 'em to do for you. They're willing to give you enough to live decent on if you're reasonable, and I'll get the most I can for you, but if you go to fighting them, they won't give you nothing."
"They'll never give me anything," she cried. "I'd never accept anything from them, but I'll take and keep what's mine, and my friends will help me."
"You'll only get yourself and your friends into a peck of trouble," he told her.
"Listen, Hal," she hesitated, stumbling a little over the speech she had been rehearsing. "There's something I want to say to you. You asked me to marry you. I told you that if you would wait a little while, I thought that I could say yes. I can't say yes, Hal, ever, for I don't love you. I'm sorry, but the only fair thing to do is tell you." He looked a bit crestfallen and disconcerted, for, though he had realized that it would be poor policy to press his suit now that she was penniless, it injured his pride to be told that he could not have won her in any event, and suddenly came the realization that, money or no money, he wanted her very much. His infatuation for Lillian Mantle was revealed in all its sordidness. It was not love. All the money in the world, all the clothes in New York, would not make Lillian Mantle as desirable as a Diana Henders. Colby was a crude, uneducated man, yet he discerned in Diana Henders a certain quality, far beyond his powers of analysis, that placed her in a sphere to which Lillian Mantle and her kind might never hope to aspire. He knew now that he wanted Diana Henders for herself, and Lillian Mantle for her money, and for that coarse feminine attraction that certain types of women have for coarse men. He lived in a more or less lawless country, and a more or less lawless age, so it is not strange that there should have crept into his mind the thought that he might possess them both. Naturally, it would be only the part of good business to possess lawfully the one with the money. It was only the flash of a thought, though, and he quickly put it aside. "I'm plumb sorry, Di," he said, "but of course you know your own business." That was all he said, but he did a great deal of thinking, and the more he thought, the more he realized how much he wanted her now that she seemed least accessible. His face wore an expression such as Diana Henders had never seen upon it before. He was not the laughing, good-natured Hal that she had liked very much and almost loved. There was something almost sinister about him, and she wondered if being disappointed in love had this effect upon men.
"How is everything at the ranch since I've been away?" she asked presently.
So-so, he replied. "Some of the hands want to quit. They're waiting till you come to get their checks."
"Who are they?"
"Pete, Shorty, and Idaho," he replied.
They'd have been the first to be let out after the change come anyhow, so it don't make no difference.
You plan to stay on as foreman? She asked.
Sure, why not? I got to work for someone, don't I?
She made no reply, and they rode on in silence toward the ranch.
He had given up trying to dissuade her. Let them do their own dirty work, he thought. As they neared the ranch, a horseman emerged from the yard and came toward them at a run amidst a cloud of dust that obscured the ranch and all else behind him. It was Texas Pete. He brought his horse to its haunches beside her and wheeled the animal about on its hind feet.
I just got in, miss, he said, and Tom told me that you'd sent word in that I was to meet you. I'm plumb sorry I was late.
Each man ignored the other as completely as though he had not existed. I understand you want to quit, Pete, said the girl. You and Shorty in Idaho. Pete looked down shamefacedly. We was aiming to, he said.
I wish you'd come up to the office and bring Shorty and Idaho with you when you get home, she said.
I want to talk with you.
All right, miss.
The three finished the ride in silence. Diana dismounted with them at the corral, and leaving her horse for Pete to unsaddle, walked toward the office. As she approached the doorway, she saw that there were several people in the room, and when she crossed the threshold, found herself face to face with Corson, Lillian Mantle, and the two Wainwrights. Corson nodded, and he and the younger Wainwright rose. Good evening, Miss Henders, said Corson. Back safely, I see. She ignored his greeting and stood for a moment silently eyeing them through narrowed lids. Her wide-brimmed sombrero sat straight and level above slightly contracted brows. A tendril of hair waved softly over one temple where it had escaped the stiff confinement of the heavy hat, but it did not tend to soften the light in those cold, steady eyes, reflecting the bitterness of her resentment toward these four. About her hips, a cartridge-filled belt supported a heavy gun, no toy such as women sometimes affect, but a .45, grim and suggestive. Its grip was shiny with usage, and the blue was worn from the steel in places. I know little about law, Mr. Corson, she said, without prelude. I have lived almost all my life a long way beyond either the protection or the menace of law. We do not bother much about it out here, but we understand moral right perfectly. We know what justice is, and we have our own ways of enforcing it. We have similar ways of protecting our just rights as well. These means I intend to invoke against you, all of you, who have come here with the intention of robbing me of what is rightly mine. Though I owe you no consideration, it is my duty to warn you that our methods in such manners are usually sudden and always unpleasant. I shall give you, Mr. Corson and Miss Mantle, an hour to leave the premises. The buckboard will be ready then. Mr. Wainwright and his son have 5 minutes, as they have no excuse whatsoever for being here. Now, go. End of chapter 15. Chapter 16 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 16. Common Criminals. An amused smile curled Mr. Corson's unpleasant mouth. Mr. Wainwright Sr. bobbed to his feet, though through no belated urge of chivalry. Lillian Mantle rose languidly, pretending to suppress a simulated yawn with the backs of her white fingers. Young Mr. Wainwright shuffled uneasily from one foot to the other. I am afraid, Miss Henders, said Corson, that you do not quite grasp the situation. It is you who fail to grasp it, Mr. Corson, snapped Diana, and please remember that you have only an hour in which to pack. Corson dropped his suavity. See here, he exclaimed. I've fooled along with you as much as I'm going to. You're the one who's going to get off this place. You haven't a right on earth here. You don't own a stick or a stone, a hoof or a tail, the length or breadth of the bar Y. Now you go and go quick, or you'll land in jail, where you belong, for the threats you've made. I imagine you'll learn something about law then. How come? Inquired a voice from the doorway, and simultaneously three figures appeared upon the veranda. You sent for us, miss, and here we are, continued Texas Pete.
And I reckon we arrive about the right time for the party, opined Shorty.
I craves the first dance with that dude in the funny pants, said Idaho, staring at Corson.
Boys, said Diana, these people are trying to rob me of the ranch, the mine, and all the cattle. I have given Mr. Corson and Miss Mantle an hour to leave the premises. Idaho, I wish that you would see that they get away on time, and drive them, or better, have Willie drive them to town. Mr. Wainwright and his son had 5 minutes in which to leave, Shorty. They have wasted three of them. Can you help them to get away on schedule? Wee, weed Shorty. Watch my smoke and their dust. Fan yourselves, gents, and he sprang into the room, circling the Wainwrights to come upon them from the rear, true to the instincts of the cowman. The elder Wainwright had arguments upon his tongue. You could see them in his eye, paradoxical as it may sound, but he permitted them to expire, voiceless, and took to his heels, followed closely by his son. Jefferson Wainwright Sr. had been run off the bar Y upon another occasion, and he had not relished the experience. He moved now with great rapidity and singleness of purpose in the direction of the corrals, his son at his heels and Shorty inconveniently close behind. To Mr. Wainwright's partial relief, Shorty had as yet indulged in no target practice, but it might come at any moment. Sympathetic perspiration streamed down the red face of Wainwright of Worcester Blankets. He almost breathed a sigh of relief when he reached the corrals, but a sudden thought froze him with terror. They could not have more than a minute left.
It would be impossible to hook up their team in that time. As he climbed through the bars, he tried to explain that impossibility to Shorty.
"Ride 'em, then," admonished their escort.
"But we have no saddles," expostulated the younger Wainwright.
"No," agreed Shorty. "You ain't got nothing but a minute, and you won't have that long. I commences shooting when the minute's up, and I ain't a-goin' to shoot for fun. I've been a-waitin' for this chance for months."
Frantically, the elder Wainwright dragged a reluctant Bronco by the halter, got him outside the corral, and struggled to clamber to his back. It was an utter failure. Then he seized the rope again, and tugging and pulling, started for the gate. His son, more successful, had succeeded in mounting the other animal, and as he trotted past his father, he whacked that gentleman's unwilling companion on the rump with the bite of his halter rope. The effects were thrilling and immediate. The Bronco leaped forward, upset Mr. Wainwright, galloped over him, and dashed out the gate into the vast, unfenced immensity.
5 seconds, announced Shorty.
Mr. Wainwright scrambled to his feet and started after the Bronco. He passed through the bar Y gate behind his son and heir with 1 second to spare. Disgusted, Shorty slipped the gun back into its holster. "Now keep going," he told them, "and don't never nary one of you come back."
"Gosh ding it," he soliloquized as he walked back toward the office. "I wish she'd only gave him 4 minutes."
He was suddenly confronted by Colby, running and out of wind.
"What you been doing?" demanded the foreman. "I just seen the tail end of it from the cookhouse winder. What in hell do you mean by it anyhow, eh?"
Shorty eyed him up and down insolently. "I ain't got no time for you, Colby," he said. "I'm getting my orders from the boss. If she tells me to run any ordinary critters off in the ranch, I'm here to run 'em off, savvy?"
"You mean Miss Henders told you to run the Wainwrights off?" demanded Colby.
"I reckon you ain't deaf," and Shorty continued his way toward the office. Colby followed him. He found Texas Pete and Idaho standing in the room. Diana was seated in her father's easy chair.
"What's the meaning of this business, Di?" demanded Colby. "Did you tell Shorty to run the Wainwrights off?"
"I ran them off, Hal," replied the girl. "I only asked Shorty to see that they went. I have told Mr. Corson and Miss Mantle to go, too. Idaho will see that they get to town safely."
"You must be crazy," exclaimed Colby. "They'll have the law on you."
"I am not crazy, Hal. I may have been a little blind, but I am far from crazy. My eyes are open now, open wide enough for me to be able to recognize my friends from my enemies."
"What do you mean?" he demanded, noting the directly personal insinuation.
"I mean, Hal, that any of my men who would contemplate working for those people after they had robbed me can't work for me. Pete has your check. He is acting foreman until Bull returns." Her chin went up proudly as she made the statement. Colby was stunned. He took the check in silence and turned toward the door, where he stopped and faced her. "Bull won't never come back," he said, "unless it's with a halter round his neck." The other three men looked toward Diana for an intimation of her wishes, but she only sat silently, tapping the toe of a spurred boot upon the Navajo rug at her feet. Colby turned once more and passed out into the gathering dusk. A half hour later, Wild Bill, otherwise and quite generally known as Willie, jogged dustily townward with Morris B. Corson, Lillian Mantle, and their baggage. Halfway there, they overtook the Wainwrights, the elder riding the single horse, which his son had given up to him, while the younger plodded along in the powdery dust. Corson told Willie to stop and take them both into the buckboard.
"Not on your life," said Willie. "I gets my orders from the boss, and she didn't say nothing about picking up no more dudes. Get up."
Later that evening, a select gathering occupied a table at one side of Gum's barroom. There were the Wainwrights, Mr. Morris B. Corson, Miss Lillian Mantle, Hal Colby, and Gum Smith. All but Gum seemed out of sorts, but then he was the only one of them who had not been run off a ranch.
"We have the law on our side, Mr. Sheriff," Corson was saying, "and all we ask is your official backing. I realize that the first thing to do is to get rid of the ruffians in her employ, and then we can easily bring her to terms. The worst of them is this man Bull, but now that he is practically an outlaw, it should be comparatively easy to get him.
I have arranged for an exceptionally large gold shipment from the mine on the next stage, and I have taken pains not to keep the matter too secret. The news is almost certain to reach him through the usual channels, and should serve as an excellent bait to lure him into another attempted hold-up of the stage.
You can be on hand, hiding, with a posse, and should you fail to get him alive, it will be all the better for society at large if you get him dead. Do you understand me?"
"That ain't no way to go about it," interrupted Colby. "You couldn't hide nowhere within 5 miles of the gap without them two hombres knowing it.
Now you just forget that scheme and leave it to me. You and your posse keep away from the gap. Just leave it to me."
"I think Hal's about right," agreed Gumsmith.
"Y'all don't know them two. They sure is foxy. Why, just look at all the times I've been after him. You just leave it to Hal here, and he sure will get him."
"All right," said Corson, "and then we can get the other three later, some way. Lure them into town one by one, and, well, I don't need to tell you gentlemen what's necessary. Only don't forget that they're worth $1,000 apiece to me if they can't bother us any more." Worn out by the excitement of the day, Diana retired to her room shortly after the lonely evening meal. She had been keyed up to a high pitch of nervous excitement for hours, and now that she had relaxed, the reaction came, leaving her tired and melancholy. She was almost too tired to undress, and so she threw herself into an easy chair and sat with her head thrown back and her eyes closed. The window of her room, overlooking the ranch yard toward the corrals,
was wide open to the cooling summer air. The lamp burning on her reading table cast its golden light upon her loosened hair and regular profile. Outside, a figure moved cautiously around the house until it stood among the trees beneath her window. The figure of a man who, looking up, could just see the outlines of the girl's face above the sill. He watched her for a moment and then glanced carefully about as though to assure himself that there was none other near. Presently, faintly, the notes of a meadow lark rose softly upon the night air. Diana's eyes flashed open. She listened intently. A moment later, the brief, sweet song was repeated. The girl rose to her feet, gathered her hair quickly into a knot at the back of her head, and ran down the stairway, along the hall, into the office. She walked quickly, her heart beating a trifle wildly, to the door. Without hesitation, she opened it and stepped out into the night. Below her stood a tall man with broad shoulders. "Bull," she exclaimed in a low whisper. The man swept his broad sombrero from his head. "Good evening, señorita," he said. "It is not Señor Bull, it is Gregorio." Diana Henders stepped back. She had removed her belt and gun. So sure had she been that it was Bull, and such confidence she had in him, that she had not given a thought to her unarmed condition. What better protection could any girl demand than just Bull? "What do you want here, Gregorio?" she demanded. The Mexican perceived the girl's surprise, saw her draw back, and grinned. It did not offend him that she might be afraid of him. He had become what he was by inspiring fear in others, and he was rather proud of it, proud of being an outlaw, proud of being hunted by the gringos, whom he knew held his courage and his gun hand, if not himself, in respect. "Do not be afraid, señorita," he said. "I was sent to you by Señor Bull with a message." He held out a long, flat envelope. "You are to read it and hide it, where the others will not find it. He says that you will know how to make use of it." She took the proffered parcel. "Why did not Señor Bull come himself?" she asked. "How should I know, señorita?" he replied. "Perhaps he thought that you would not want the black coyote to come here. He knew that you recognized him today. He saw it in your eyes." She was silent a moment, as though weighing the wisdom of a reply to his statement, but she made none. "Is that all, Gregorio?" she asked. "That is all, señorita." "Then thank you, and goodbye. Thank Señor Bull, too, and tell him that his job is waiting for him when he can come back." Gregorio swept his hat low and turned back into the shadows. Diana entered the office and closed the door. Going directly to her room, she took a chair beneath the reading lamp and examined the outside of the envelope Gregorio had given her. It was addressed to Morris B. Corson. How had Bull come by it? But of course she knew. It was a piece of the mail that had come into his possession through the robbing of the stage. The girl shuddered and held it away from her. She saw that the envelope had been opened. Bull had done that. She sat looking at the thing for a long time. Could she bring herself to read the contents? It had not been meant for her. To read it, then, would be to put herself on a par with the black coyote. She would be as much a thief as he. The only right and proper thing to do was to get the letter into Corson's hands as quickly as possible. She could not be a party to Bull's crime. She laid it, almost threw it, in fact, upon the table as though it were an unclean thing, and sat for a long time in deep thought. Occasionally her eyes returned to the letter. The thing seemed to hold a malignant fascination for her. What was in it? It must concern her, or Bull would not have sent it to her. She would send it to Corson the first thing in the morning. Bull would not ask her to read something that did not concern her. She rose and commenced to remove her clothing. Once or twice, as she passed the table, she stopped and looked at the envelope, and at last, in her nightrobe, as she went to blow out the lamp, she stood for a full minute staring at the superscription. Again she argued that Bull would not have sent it to her had it been wrong for her to read it. Then she extinguished the light and got into bed. For an hour, Diana Henders tossed about, sleepless. The envelope upon the reading table haunted her. It had no business there. It belonged to Morris B. Corson. If it were to be found in her possession, she could be held guilty as the robber who took it from the United States mail pouch. They could send her to jail. Somehow that thought did not frighten her at all. What was in it? It must be something concerning the property they were trying to steal from her. They were thieves. One was almost justified in taking any steps to frustrate their dishonest plans. Suddenly she recalled what Mary Donovan had said. "You've got to fight the devil with fire." And then Diana Henders flung the covers from her and swung her feet to the floor. A moment later she had lighted the lamp. There was no more hesitation. She took up the envelope and extracted its contents, which consisted of three papers. The first she examined was a brief letter of transmission noting the enclosures and signed by a clerk in Corson's office. The second was John Mannell's will, the later will that Corson had told her did not exist. She read it through carefully. Word for word, it was a duplicate of the last will her father had made, except for the substitution of Elias Hender's name as beneficiary. The clause leaving the property to their joint heirs in the event of her father's prior death followed. Suddenly, Diana experienced a sensation of elation and freedom such as had not been hers since her father's death. She could fight them now. She had something to fight with. And Lillian Mannell could claim only what was legally hers. An even division would entail unpleasant complications of administration, but at least they could not take her share from her.
They might sell theirs. They might and probably would sell it to the Wainwrights, which would be horrible, of course. But she would stand her ground and get her rights, no matter who owned the other half. She laid the will aside and picked up the third paper. It was a letter, in her uncle's familiar handwriting, addressed to her father. Dear L., in the event that I go first, I want to ask you to look after Lillian for me, at least until she is married. Since her mother's death, she has no one but me, and naturally I feel not only a certain responsibility for her, but a real affection that is almost paternal, since she was but a year old when I married her mother. She has never known any other father, her own having been killed before she was born. Although she knows the truth concerning her parentage, I think she looks upon me as a father, and if I am unable to do so, I know that you will provide for her. I did not mention her in my will, because our understanding included only our legal heirs, or should I say heir now, since Diana is the only one left. And as she will inherit all our property eventually, I hope that you will pass this request on to her, which I shall leave attached to my will. Affectionately, John. Diana sat with staring eyes fixed upon the letter in her hand, and she had almost sent these papers back to Corson. She shuddered as she thought of the narrow escape she had had. Why, they were no better than common criminals, and she was the sole heir to the Bar Y. She did not think of the gold mine, or the value of the great herds and the broad acres. She thought only of the Bar Y as something that she loved, as home. Now no one could take it away from her, and yet she was not happy. There was a little rift within the lute. Bull was an outlaw. And who else was there than Bull upon whom she might depend for guidance and advice in the handling of her affairs? He was a good cattleman. Her father had always said that, and had had confidence in his judgment and ability. His one fault, they had thought, had been his drinking, and this, she felt intuitively, he had overcome. Of his loyalty there had never been any doubt until the whisperings of the ugly rumors that had connected him with the robberies of the stage. These she had consistently refused to believe, even to the point of denying the evidence of her own eyes. But Gregorio had definitely confounded the remnants of her hopes. Yet still, she thought of Bull as her sole resource. Even now she had confidence in him. She could not fathom the mental processes that permitted her mind to dwell upon him without loathing or contempt. But, after all, was she being influenced by the dictates of her mind? She shrank from contemplation of the alternative, yet it persistently obtruded itself upon her reveries. If her mind refused to fly to the defense of Bull, then it must be her heart that championed him. What reason would not do, love had accomplished. She flushed at the thought and tried to put it aside, for it was impossible. It could not be that she, Diana Henders, could love an outlaw and a criminal. No, she must put Bull out of her mind forever, and with this resolve mingling with her tears, she fell asleep. End of chapter 16.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.